coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. Dover Air Force Base personnel were among those involved in the August evacuation of refugees from Afghanistan.
I think when we landed the first time, the cargo door opened and seeing 400 people, that's all they have, right? And it's time to go. That was the first, like, okay. And then you start feeling this emotional security, like, this is my plane. These are my people. Nobody's touching this. We're going to get you guys out.
We talk with two airmen about their experiences during that massive evacuation. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also hear the story of an Afghan refugee that came to the U.S. through Delaware in 2017 and how the U.S. withdrawal in August affected him and his family. Plus, we update progress on the Reach Riverside project in Wilmington. It's all next on The Green, where Delaware gets tuned into a first state of mind. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. The evacuation of Afghan refugees and U.S. personnel from Afghanistan in August was a massive undertaking. And while there has been criticism of how the Biden administration handled ending the U.S. presence there, there is no argument that the evacuation effort, known as Operation Allies Refuge, is considered the largest non-combatant evacuation operation in history. And Dover Air Force Base played a role, with the 3rd Airless Squadron flying more than 90 missions to help transport over 7,000 passengers and more than 200 pallets of cargo. The base also had members of its maintenance, medical, and security groups participating in the operation. Captain Travis Parrott and Senior Airman Duncan Copley were among those involved in the effort, and they joined me earlier this week to give their firsthand accounts of what it was like. Let's introduce you to our audience and have you give a quick sense of how long you've been at Dover and what you do there. And Captain Parrott, we'll start with you.
Yeah, sure. First of all, thanks for having us come in today. I showed up at Dover in late 2019 in August. I graduated pilot training in 2019, earlier that year. So this was actually my first base as a pilot. Mm-hmm. I have a prior history in the military. This is 12 years for me. So I had two other jobs. One was a maintainer on F-15s. First duty station was in Okinawa, Japan. And then I had a job as a navigator on KC-135 aircraft in McConnell Air Force Base in Kansas. So I've been here for about 2 years. I scaled the entire Delaware state to find a nice nesting ground, and I ended up down in Lewis, about 30 minutes south. I love it down there. I love the Delaware community. I'm from Indiana originally. So for some reason, if you can stick cornfields next to a beach, I'm a happy guy. So.
Senior Airman Copley, how about yourself?
I've been at Dover for almost 3 years now, mm-hmm. and I've been in the military for four in December. So, yeah.
And tell us a little bit about what you do at Dover.
At Dover, I've primarily been a loadmaster, loading cargo on C-17s. I'm an instructor loadmaster, so I've been teaching newer student loadmasters on how to properly perform their job. Also, while I've been here, I was at the Honor Guard for a while, and I did the base Honor Guard, paying respects to fallen service members. So,
well, let's talk a little bit about why we have you here, and that is your role in Operation Allies Refuge. We'll start with you, Captain Parrott. Just talk a little bit about the mission and what you were doing. Obviously, you're flying the planes.
Right. Yeah. So the mission is interesting. So when we got the call in the squadron, or me particularly, it was about 16 hours between the next phone call. So within 24 hours, we were called to take off. Now, when I went home to pack, you're not really sure. It's about 2 weeks you pack for. Where are you going to go? You're not sure. Just a typical thing. Sometimes you know ahead of time. Sometimes you don't. This is obviously a unique scenario. And within 24 hours, we had a very, very, very long day. Ended up in our next location realized it was like, oh, we are timing out. We have only a certain amount of time we can fly in the aircraft before we have to hand that aircraft off to the next crew or call it for the day. Given the constraints of the mission and how dire it was, we just handed the aircraft off to the next crew. And I think, interesting enough, the next crew, when we got off the plane, I shook hands with the other co-pilot. We ended up being buddies just earlier in the year, deployed. And he was like, looks like I'm taking over. And he takes over and find out he was the aircraft that had the 800 people on board.
Wow.
So it was a very, very, very cool, very unique experience, but also an eye-opening experience to see me handing off to somebody I know and then hearing his account at the end of it. So you knew right away this was a big deal, and the mission was very important. And then as it kind of unfolded and you saw people from around the community, all across the states, all in one location, working for the same goal. Everybody was fired up. Everybody was ready to do this, and the support was overwhelming. And so that was kind of the first way of realizing the gravity of the situation and this mission.
You mentioned, you know, hearing your friend's account of what he went through. Can you tell us a little bit about what he kind of relayed to you?
So I can tell you a little bit about it. I think at the time it kind of felt like more routine. Mm-hmm. He was just kind of delivering cargo there. I can't speak too much to
sure.
it, but
Understood.
For as far as like his account was that, okay, this is much bigger than just a normal mission, right? This is going to be fast. This is going to have to be accurate. We're going to have to get a flow. And we're going to have to execute the way we were trained. And he said, just be ready. And there's going to be a lot of challenges moving forward. And he's right. I mean, there was a lot of challenges for us. And we ended up knocking it out of the park, I think, as a crew. And we were trained to do so. So we do that a lot.
Senior McCauley, how about from your perspective, what was the mission like for you?
So I got called after everyone else got sent out there. So I showed up a few days late. I was back home visiting with family. So they rushed me back to Dover. I got there, and then I got rushed out to where we're staying, where we would stay deployed. And I sat there, waited a few days, and then they finally called us to go into Kabul and start taking people out. So, yeah, at first it was like everyone was gung-ho, ready to go. And my crew specifically didn't get utilized a little bit later because there's other crews that they're using, and we're just on standby waiting to get the call to go in. And finally we did, and we ended up going in to Kabul four times.
And so when you were in there, what was it like? You know, I guess what were you doing, and what was kind of like, you know, your impressions of what was happening as mm-hmm. you were doing it?
When I got in Kabul, it was after like the initial challenges that everyone faced out there. So it was very orderly, very structured. Like it felt like pretty standard, like mission-wise. Like they'd bring out the passengers, we'd upload them, I just followed my training and like we trained for this, so it made it a little bit easier, like just going through the whole situation and like uploading people.
Is it different uploading people rather than cargo, like particularly in a situation like this?
In a situation like this, so I did both. So mm-hmm. I had helicopters on one flight, and then I had close to 400 passengers on another, and we were tasked to load passengers on the flight where I had we had helicopters we were taking out. We weren't expecting that. So we showed up and they're like, hey, you're going to have two helicopters and however many like Air Force personnel, and kind of took me off guard. Like, so I had to do my primary job that I had been doing the entire time, like that I've been doing for the last 3 years. And it kind of like took me back, settled me. And I was like, okay, this is what I do all the time. So I'll go load these helicopters, load these passengers and get on out. So going back to loading passengers, it was just, Like I said, we've got training for this, so it was pretty standard.
As you're both talking, yeah. It sounds like your training is what kind of kicks in here, and so you know that's what you're kind of focusing on. But do the circumstances, particularly in this case, ever kind of change your perception of what you're doing? You need to take that second maybe to be like, okay, like this is a little bit different, but I need to stick with what I'm doing.
Absolutely. And I think, and I don't want to speak for, you know, everybody that did these missions,
sure.
but I think there is some element that, you know, once the gravity of a situation like this, you know, there's only a few times in history when the entire world stops and looks at what's going on in mm-hmm. the news, right? And this was happening right here, right now in Afghanistan, and everybody we knew was doing it. And so we knew it was a big deal, and when you put that kind of pressure on, and sure, yeah, it is a little bit different. A unique piece about our training is in a lot of military training, and I've been through a lot of it. So anything from enlisted maintenance to navigator to pilot, there's simple injects of confusion that are intentional. There are simple elements of doubt that they put in there. There are a lot of additional stresses and challenges that they put in the training because they know they can't prepare you for every situation to see everything. So you play these what ifs. And so when we go and we plan these missions and we go and we fly these flights and these sorties, so to speak. So when we do that, we have to break them down into bites. And so it's either how are we going to get off the ground? All right. how are we going to get these people on board or this cargo on board? Once we take off, is there terrain involved? Is there going to be something with the weight and CG that our load masters have to deal with? Is there going to be something unique that we could have a leak, or is there somebody that could be shot at? How are we going to go in to do this? So if you break it down into chunks, I think that helps to manage like the gravity, because now you're looking at such a smaller scope. But like you said, does this type of mission create an additional challenge? Absolutely, because when the doors open and the first time you see 400 people at the back of your door with nothing that they've had this whole time, or nothing left from their homes, their kids, no diapers, some are pregnant, it's 100 degrees, you know, the weight of seeing that and what they're there for to get out immediately, fear of their life or just need to get out, then that weight hits you. And so now you have to kind of take back and go, okay, it's not just taking this bite in this phase. Now I've got a new role. Now I've got I'm a sense of security. Let's keep it orderly. Let's keep the communication straight. Let's make this go as smoothly as possible. So I think everybody, the big play for this mission is CRM, which is what we call crew resource management. It's the communication against the crew to keep the temperature down when things get high, or to keep the flow and the movement of people and the movement of the mission very seamless and as smooth as possible. And so it's just keeping a cool head, and that was the challenge, I think, and the newer challenge because, yeah, we see it in training, but when it hits you, when the doors open, there's 400 people, they're ready to go, and the mission drives it, and it's important, then, yeah, that was the big challenge.
When you're talking about that, to kind of just keeping it orderly, as you're dealing with – do you wind up dealing a lot with the passengers themselves and kind of, you know, keeping them kind of, you know, orderly, keeping things moving and keeping things, you know, as orderly and calm as possible, I guess, is the way you're looking for.
I'm not going to speak. And Duncan, you could probably tell a lot more. He was in the back. A lot of the pilots are up top. So I think he could tell more. But it was a collective of a lot of people on the ground, a lot of support.
Yeah. We had a lot of support agencies working towards, like, the common goal of getting the refugees to where they need to go. And in flight, like, we face things that we normally wouldn't face. Like, C-17, we normally don't give out food on flights and stuff like that. But we always have water. But for, like, this magnitude of a mission, I had to preemptively make sure that we had water bottles and everything on the jet for the 400 or 500 passengers that we could be taking. So there was, like, some decision-making and planning that we had to do before we even, like, took off with that to, like, make sure people were getting, like, their basic human rights and needs. But with, like, in-flight, me personally, I didn't have, like, any anybody, like, getting really upset or anything because they weren't getting food or whatever. But we did have the challenges of, like, handing out food in a cargo compartment that you can barely, like, walk around because there's just so many people. And our flights were, like, roughly 4 hours, so people would, like, lay down and try to sleep. And so moving through the cargo compartment was, like, a little bit of not, like, an issue, but it was like, a little harder to do than
different.
Normal.
And
right?
You're trying to be kind of respectful of people's space and such, right?
Yeah. So I would say, like, the biggest challenge we faced on the jet is just, like, making sure people got food who needed food and that, like, it was, like, evenly dispersed and nobody, like, felt like somebody was getting better treatment than somebody else.
Right, and I guess that's hard when you've got that many people and you're trying to keep track of everything you're doing in sequence. You mentioned earlier about you had multiple flights and they had to be quick. Can you talk a little bit about, I guess, that challenge and, you know, making sure that you know, the train keeps running?
Yeah. So I can only speak to, like, from a pilot's perspective. Mm-hmm. A lot of that was handled by a support agency on the ground where we were staged at. So and hats off to those guys. Like, you're working hundreds of crews, hundreds of, you know, lots of planes, and you're trying to keep as many in the air as possible, right? And then you have maintenance problems on top of it. So as far as that goes, we would come down from a flight and try to get another crew would try to tap us out, get us off the plane so we can go into crew rest, get the rest we needed. And then once that certain time period had elapsed, we were able to be alerted again for the next one. And they just kind of hopscotch like that. As far as the aircraft go, I think maintenance personnel would probably have to speak better to that. But I do know that that those were challenges. Hot weather, you know, you're running them all the time. The air conditioning systems were like at the time struggling to maintain this weather and these conditions. So that flow in the beginning, it was challenging and getting the crews to move around. But they did a phenomenal job towards the end, like ironing that out so that they kept a plane moving every time.
And it sounds to me, I mean, the thing I'm kind of taking away from what you're telling me is that, you know, when you talk about something like this, that's such a massive effort, like historically massive.
Right.
I mean, this really requires the team all doing their parts. I mean, you talk about kind of compartmentalizing and, you know, taking things in chunks, but it's also each team doing its chunk, right?
Absolutely. Yep. And like, hats off, even back here at Dover, which was insane. So like, we had guys and people from the ninth, and the ninth is the C5 unit at Dover, and the third, you know, spouses reaching out to the Dover community. They had over $20,000 worth of cargo that they gave. It was hygiene products, baby care, supplies, whatever. And then, you know, obviously financial donations that they were able to do that. So not just the team, like, on the stage, but you're talking about the community back here, which is – thank you very much, by the way. This shout out to Dover for that. That was huge. That made a huge difference for the well-being and what we could do on the plane, because we could hand that stuff out. So we were the vessel for your effort. We really appreciate that. But as far as the teams out there, yeah, you're talking medical, you're talking the transportation, you're talking maintenance, the command and control center. How do we get people in and out of this plane? How do we get people back into crew rest? How do we get them from their dorms to here? Mm-hmm. Constantly running trains of transportation. This operation, I don't know how to understate this. This is massive. And what they did was absolutely impressive.
From your standpoint, I mean, obviously it's like you're focusing on what you're doing, but you have to be able to rely on the rest of the team doing their part so that you can stay focused on what you're doing, right?
Yeah. So this was definitely like a huge crew effort, like just within the aircraft and then outside the aircraft, all our support agencies. Everyone was doing phenomenal so that these missions could be like run and so that we could get people to the States and wherever else that they may be now. But it was definitely like a huge group effort to get this entire operation like successful. So, yeah.
People, you know, on the outside looking in have seen the photos and the videos of what was happening during this evacuation effort. For you each, and we'll start with you, is there something that kind of stuck with you, that sticks with you from what you saw, what you heard, what you were doing during that mission?
Yeah, so for me, normally when we're moving missions, you don't get to see the outcome of your mission. Like, you'll move some Suburbans from one place to another, and it's like, okay, you did that. But, like, you don't see the long-lasting effects that you've had on, like, the mission. And with this, you, like, the news is covering a lot, so you can see a lot that you have directly impacted. Like, personally, I moved 940 refugees out of Kabul, and, like, seeing that they're back here and they're living a healthy life and, like, things are looking good, like, that's really awesome to see. And one of the missions while I was out there, it was the first one. Yeah, it was actually the first mission we were out there. We moved 250 refugees and some aeromedical patients back to Qatar. And one of the personnel that we moved was a translator. Mm-hmm. And I was like, hey, we need to get this guy like helping us translate so that we could talk. And two missions later, he walked up to the jet. He's like, hey, what's up? Like, a friendly face. And it was cool to see that I had that impact on the entire mission, that, hey, I brought this guy back and now he's helping us.
Pointed out like, hey, this guy could be useful, right?
Yeah, exactly. And like, it was just really cool to see that. So
that's awesome.
Yeah, throughout the whole experience, I was really
happy. How about for you, Captain?
I think that one of the big things for me was like, it's kind of more of an introspective look, but how the impact of something this big, it comes in waves. Mm-hmm. So initially, like I said, you compartmentalize your job to get very challenging aspects done and keep your mind focused in different bites, but I think when we landed the first time, the cargo door opened and seeing 400 people, that's all they have, right? And it's time to go. That was the first, like, okay. And then you start feeling this emotional security, like, this is my plane. These are my people. Nobody's touching this. We're going to get you guys out. And I think there was a sentiment that felt across the force. But I think the second wave was once you started seeing how many people were involved and how actively engaged and how bad they wanted to go in and get people out. So this huge sense of community now. And then when you got back, it was like, then you started taking in just how much we did, because you only see little bits at a time, right? I don't see all the numbers. They don't tell you, hey, we're at this number, right? And then when you get back, you go like, oh my God, I was a part of that. And then not only that, the shout out to Dover's like support community as far as the maintenance, or as far as the healthcare, as far as everybody, every support agency, when we landed, they were there to help. Hey, do you need to talk about anything? Hey, do you need some time? Do you need us to help you with some paperwork? Whatever. It was impressive. Everybody wanted a hand in it. So, and then I think one other memorable moment was like being able to take a blanket out of my bag and give it to somebody. And you saw this happen. And you heard of this happening across a lot of planes. It was like, how can I give something of mine right. to you to make your stay or your travel easier? This is not easy on anybody. So any way we could do it was kind of a comfort role we played, which is very cool.
Thanks to Captain Travis Parrott and Senior Airman Duncan Copley from Dover Air Force Base for joining us on The Green this week to share their stories from the evacuation of Afghan refugees. And stay with us. Delaware Public Media's Roman Battaglia offers some insight into what may lie ahead for those refugees from an Afghan interpreter who fled to the U.S. 4 years ago. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. As we heard in our last segment, the U.S. brought tens of thousands of refugees here from Afghanistan in August as it withdrew its forces from that country and the Taliban recaptured it. Many families, including 10 here in Delaware, arrived with almost nothing, seeking a better life here in the United States. What's next for these refugees? Each story is different, but Delaware Public Media's Roman Battaglia recently got some insight from Sadiq, a former Afghan interpreter who fled his country in 2017 and came to Delaware. Sadiq shared his story with Roman, describing the threats his family faced from the Taliban, his escape to the U.S., and how his parents were forced into hiding as the Taliban retook the country in August. And Roman brings us that story this week in Sadiq's own words.
My name is Sadiq. I'm a network engineer. Working for Mediacom. I'm living in Pennsylvania, Matamoras. We didn't know, like, we wanted Taliban to go away completely. We wanted to help in a way. I wanted to join ANA first, you know, Afghan National Army. Like, I didn't mean to work with American, but then I was told if I work with American, since I know English, I can do better. I can help my country better, you know. I was hired with PGS, that's the company, working with U.S. Military and civilian, you know, teaching, training Afghan officials. Everyone's intent was to help, like, their country, like, to fix a broken piece of the country, yeah. But sometimes the things doesn't go how you want it, you know, and that's one of the bad things, you know. We cannot control many things, you know. Then when I was in Kandahar, my wife was threatened, you know, like the Taliban broke the window with a stone. And my wife was doing the laundry. So when she heard the sound, then she came. She rushed out, like, what's going on? Then the Taliban was on the motorbike, and they were aiming, like when you use your hand to, like, cutting the head off. As a sign, they were doing that to my wife. And my wife was scared, like, crying. Like, when she was calling me, she was like, Sadiq, they did that, you know, then. Yeah, unfortunately, then that night was I was destroyed. You know, like, I couldn't go back to my hometown, and also, I mean, I couldn't do nothing. You know, I was like, what to do? Like, I already moved here and there. So a friend of mine, an American friend of mine, came to me, like, told me, hey, what's up, Sadiq? You're not concentrating. What's wrong with you these days? You know, like, you're not working, actually, you know. Like, I mean, I was super destroyed. Like, I was like, I don't know, like, maybe he's right, yeah. I didn't want to tell him first, because that was my problem, that's what I thought. Then he kind of insist And then I told him the story. Then he was devastated. I mean, he was ruined. Like, then he said, like, how, you know, do you, I mean, then he said, how can I help you? Then I said, I don't know. I mean, I cannot go back. Then he said, he searched for me. He did his search here and there. And he found out a program called SIV, Special Immigrant Visa for Afghan interpreters. So, who are at risk, then he said, I want to help you with this, you know, I mean, do you want to go to America? I said, let me think, you know, because I wanted to ask my wife this time. I didn't want to hide from her. So then I told her, like, this is a program. We might approve or we might not get approved or we might get rejected, but I would like to try to go to America. During the 24 hours, I think 18 hours that I was coming to, we were on the flight coming, I was like deeply thinking, like, what am I going to face with, you know, like, where are we going to sleep tonight, you know? I mean, I don't know, maybe these are like some crazy questions, but I was asking myself, like, I have two kids, my wife, and I don't know anything about America, like, what's going to happen to me? Yeah, I cannot forget that night, actually. It was, I can remember every bit of it. So then four people from one car and three people from another car came out, and they came and hugged us, you know, kissed us, hugged us, you know, like, hey, how are you doing? Very glad you're here. Like, then I was thinking, like, who are you? I mean, like, do you know me? You know, do I know you? I'm like, excuse me, can I introduce myself first? You know, before all this talk, I thought if I'm being mistaken with someone else, you know, like, yeah, I know you. You're Sadiq, right? I said, yes. Yeah. Then they said, oh, I mean, then I was like, okay, I'm safe here, you know. Then, yeah, like, wow, that night was like a great night. Like, they hugged my kids. They told us, don't worry, we are here to help you. Like, oh, okay, thank you very much. Still confused a little, but super happy. Everything was a big shock for us. Like, you know, when they were training us, like, for example, the shopping store, they were super big, you know, like, I mean, in Afghanistan, we had a very small shop, for example, and there were only one type of apple, for example, and you didn't have much option, you know, like here you had like 10 or 12 kind of apple, you know, like green apple, like, so there are a lot of things like that, you know, to be honest, I don't remember. I could talk to my family through like social media, like through the phone, but I couldn't go there, you know, sometimes you wanna, like, you know, kiss, I mean, we have a like a tradition to kiss our dad's hand, like, yeah, we would like to go there and to pay our respect, and, you know, because he did a lot, he sacrificed many for us, and yet we cannot do anything for them. My father and my parents-in-law, my parents, they were open-minded people, so they led their kids to study, to get educated, to learn as much as they can, to help the country, to help here and there. So yeah, and we did actually succeed in what we were doing. Like, I have a sister who is a doctor. She's a doctor. Now the things turned away, so then we are in danger, because we did work with either coalition forces or the government or international organization. So now we are a target, you know. So then when the Taliban took over the whole country, my father kind of ran away, like moved many times, like within the province, and to different provinces. The night that the things happened, the attack happened, so Taliban attacked Herat. So that night, we didn't know about that attack. We were camping in Glenwood Park somewhere in Pennsylvania. So we were there two nights enjoying our time. The kids were happy. So we in that place, we have no signal, you know, as far as the phone is not working, no internet. So when we came back, we were rained with a lot of messages, like, where are you? Like, can you know? Like, when my dad was rushing out of the house trying to save his life, he wanted to burn some documents and some pictures, you know? So for pictures and those things, he was asking my permission. Like, can I burn some of your picture or like your pictures, all your pictures? Then I was like worried, like what? Like, then I got the news, Taliban attack our village, actually specific our village. Then I was scared, like very scared. Like, I tried to call like as many sources as I had, like, hey, you know, do you know about my dad or any? Like, then finally after 2 days or after some hour, like 28 hours, I guess. So he takes me back, like, don't stop calling people, you know, we are in a place right now, so no one knows where we are. He didn't even tell me where he is at. So yeah, that night was the craziest night, you know, like one of those very crazy night that I had in my life. Like, I thought if he's dead, you know, like I was like 99% kind of sure, like, he's dead, there's no doubt, you know, like, he's certainly dead. But no, he was alive. And yeah, I mean, that was another kind of, I was happy in a way, and I was so sad in another way. In touch with JFS, we are part of that community now. If you know, like, our friend, you know, it's not like because we were first there. Like, we become one now. You know, like, I am in touch with every one of them. Like, actually, I am looking to come back to Delaware for many reasons. We already communicate some, like, we advise them with some stuff, like, you know, what a family, what an Afghan family might need when they come to the United States. So yeah, we are communicating with them. So you know, my wife actually is going to visit them, so to talk to them, to hear from them, to see what's the problem, how we can help them. So yeah, that's what we are going to do and what we are doing already. In my case, I knew English. I knew the culture a little bit. I was working with an American, but there are some people who doesn't know how to speak English. And there are some people who doesn't have that skill here to work, and that is going to be difficult for them. I can promise them, these people are going to be a great asset for United States and for Delaware. So I mean, when I was in Afghanistan, so I mean, like they had a dream to find a safe place to study, to work hard, to build their life. So this family are coming to build a good life. They are coming to build a good society because they are tired of the society they had. They are tired of the war. They are tired of many bad things they had from their previous, I don't know, the previous life or that country. So they want to gain and work hard for what they are going to gain in new place. And so if you help them a little bit, they can go so much, you know, because they are so ready. to learn. They're all so ready. That's, I can promise that. I mean, that will happen for sure.
Thanks again to Sadiq for sharing his story with us here on The Green, and to our Roma Battaglia for helping him tell it. You can hear more from this interview at DelawarePublic.org, where you can also find resources to help Afghan refugees. And we wrap up The Green next with an update on the Reach Riverside project in Wilmington, which just received a boost from federal COVID relief funds this week. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. The ongoing redevelopment of Wilmington's Riverside neighborhood, known as Reach Riverside, is making strides. And the project's pace is poised to accelerate after receiving just over $26 million in federal COVID relief funds this week. Contributor Larry Nagengast has been following Reach Riverside since its launch. This week, in his latest piece at DelawarePublic.org, he offers an update on where things stand now and what's next on the project timeline. And he joined me earlier this week to discuss what he found.
Let's refresh people's memories about the Riverside Project. Can you give us a quick thumbnail sketch of what the project's all about? What's the overall game plan here?
Okay. Well, the overall game plan calls for a massive transformation of what's really a long-neglected, low-income neighborhood, majority black, in the northeast corner of Wilmington. Riverside was built at the end of World War II, primarily to provide affordable housing for veterans returning from combat. Now, over time, the GI Bill, which was passed several years after the end of the war, it helped mainly white veterans buy their own homes, usually out in the suburbs, and over time, Riverside became a subsidized housing unit managed by the Wilmington Housing Authority, and its demographic became primarily black and low income. Many would describe Riverside as a product of systemic racism. Now, for example, 70% of the children in Riverside live in poverty, and that's nearly triple the state average. 41% of the adults lack a high school diploma. 87% of the households are led by single women. Now, the plan is to change that dynamic, that demographic, through improved housing and a support system that is quite strong. Reach Riverside, which is the redevelopment organization overseeing the project, has allied itself with Purpose Built Communities, which is a nonprofit based in Atlanta, Georgia, that has a solid record of overseeing transformations like this one. New housing, nearly 600 units or so, some of them subsidized, some of them to be rented at market rates, will be the major piece. But the $250 million plan, which will probably take 10 years or so to execute, includes making the business corridor along Northeast Boulevard on the edge of Riverside more in alignment with the needs of the community's residents. That means a grocery store and more retail rather than a lot of auto body shops. And it also includes providing services essential to uplifting a community. Things like healthcare, financial counseling, job training, social services, all of these located in facilities within the community so they're easy for residents to access.
So you've been following this since day one. How is the project's timeline holding up? You talked about it taking a decade. That's a long timeline. Where are things at right now with the first couple of phases?
Well, it seems like I've been saying this every time I'm talking with you, Tom, no matter what the subject, but it's no surprise that the pandemic slowed things down. Back in 2018, when the master plan was unveiled, the target date for starting construction was 2020. Early 2020, that is. But the pandemic, coupled with the typical delays in nailing down financing for such a large project, meant that construction of the first phase of the redevelopment, 74 units, didn't start until last December. Most of the exterior work on those units has been completed, and the contractors are now working inside on electrical, heating, insulation, ventilation systems, and so on. And those first apartments should be ready for occupancy in late winter or early spring. Meanwhile, work on the second phase, 67 more apartment units, will start in December and should be finished by the end of next year. In short, we've got a late start, but no further delays, and they're making steady progress.
The big news this week is a little more than $26 million in federal COVID relief funds are being poured into this project. How much will that boost change the trajectory of this project?
Yeah. Well, as I said, financing projects like this is a very complex operation with funding from government sources, banks, foundations, and other sources of loans. Now, a big piece of this funding is derived from tax credits that are awarded for building low and moderate income housing, but it takes a lot of time for these credits to be approved. What's happening here is that this $26 million in COVID relief funds will enable Reach Riverside to start work on the next three phases of the project, another 200 units or so, without having to wait for the tax credits to be approved. And as I understand it, those tax credits can be used for later phases of the project anyhow. In any case, the work that would be covered and benefit from the relief funds will start at the end of next year, the end of 2022. And instead of building 65 to 75 units, one phase at a time, stretched over maybe 3 years, they're going to be able to build instead about 100 units a year and having 200 or so units ready for occupancy then by the end of 2024.
And as these units are made ready, explain to us again how they're going to be made available to those who will wind up occupying them.
Okay, well, first priority will go to current residents of the Wilmington Housing Authority units in Riverside. Now, in the next month or so, Penrose Incorporated, which is the project manager, will be sending information to eligible WHA residents on how to apply for the units. WHA residents eligible for subsidized housing will pay rents on the same basis that they do now, adjusted according to their income, their family size, and the size of their housing unit. Let me mention here that, the old Riverside housing is going to be torn down to make way for the new homes. So what's going to happen here is that the first residents who will be moved into the new Riverside will most likely be coming from the first of the older units that are scheduled for demolition. Now, not all of the units in the new Riverside will be subsidized public housing style. Some of them are going to be available at market rates, and that will be roughly $800 a month for a one-bedroom unit, $900 for two bedrooms, and $1,000 a month for three. The goal here is to create a mixed-use community with residents from a variety of income levels. Ryan Bailey, Penrose's project manager, says that this can be a tough sell at first, convincing folks that it's a good deal to move into new homes in what used to be a public housing neighborhood. But Penrose, and purpose-built communities as well, have had success with this approach in other cities, and they're confident that prospective residents will be pleased when they see the quality of the housing and the other changes that are going to be taking place in the neighborhood in the next couple of years.
Of course, housing is not the only piece of Reach Riverside, as you've mentioned. A new Kingswood Community Center is also in the works. What is the status of that part of the project?
Well, again, the Kingswood Community Center has been the centerpiece of the Riverside neighborhood for about 75 years. It's home to a senior center and a child care service. It's a space for recreation, community meetings, social services, and much more. But it's crowded and it's outdated. Plans call for a new $41 million building covering some 70,000 square feet, and it would be built just to the northeast of the current building on Bowers Street. It would double the size of the child care program, and it would have room for an expanded Christiana Care health clinic and lots of other community services, not to mention a larger gym and more meeting rooms. Logan Herring, who is the CEO of both Reach Riverside and Kingswood, says that they've already raised $11 million, and a public-facing campaign to raise the rest of the money, another $30 million, is just getting started. Herring would like to see construction begin in the spring of 2023, and it's probably maybe a two-year project or so for the whole thing to be built.
There's also a business / I guess economic development piece to this. What can you tell us about where that stands and where that's going?
Well, again, the business component is something that's called RESTORE, which is an acronym for Real Estate Strategy to Obtain Racial Equity. The Wells Fargo Bank Regional Foundation has already kicked in $500,000 to get this initiative started. The idea is to build up a fund that will be large enough for each Riverside to go out and buy vacant and dilapidated properties, again, primarily along Northeast Boulevard, and then work with builders and developers to put up shops and other service businesses that would serve the day-to-day needs of Riverside residents. One of the top priorities would be a grocery store, since many Riverside residents do rely on public transportation, and the closest supermarket is nearly 2 miles away.
And Larry, we've also seen Reach Riverside step up to help with more immediate issues that aren't necessarily part of the proposed timeline and project. We saw it during COVID, and now with the fallout from the flooding caused by the remnants of Hurricane Ida. What are they doing to assist the flooding victims at this point?
Yeah, well, as you indicated, last year during the pandemic, Reach Riverside raised some money so they could partner with TD Bank to issue debit cards to the WHA Riverside residents up to $750 per household to help them buy essential items for about 3 months while they were out of work or experiencing a loss of income. Now they're gearing up to help a different group. The residents of that area, it's actually just outside Riverside, but along Vandiver Avenue and East 12th Street. It's a neighborhood sometimes referred to as the 11th Street Bridge Colony. And those homes were swamped when the Brandywine overflowed its banks during Hurricane Ida last month. Now, Reach Riverside has already raised more than $700,000, which is a considerable amount of money to be raising in a short time. And they hope to distribute as much as $2,500 to each of 200 to 300 households in the form of rechargeable $250 debit cards. The plans of this are still being fleshed out, but it should be pretty soon before some of that money starts flowing into the neighborhood to help those residents rebuild.
All right, let's pull back out again now and talk big picture. When we talk about big projects like this one, we often look at the question of, you know, can they build, then maintain momentum? Has Reach Riverside proven itself capable of that? Is it well on its way to reaching its lofty goals?
The cautious answer, and I like to be cautious, is I see no reason why Reach Riverside can't maintain the momentum, but we're really going to know much better in a year or so after residents move into the first two sections of the new housing and the work begins on the subsequent sections and the fund drive for the new Kingswood is further along. But you have to admit, it's been a major lift to accomplish what has been put in motion thus far, especially when you take the pandemic into consideration. And we haven't even mentioned the warehouse, the community center for teenagers, that finally opened this year after a year of those pandemic-related delays. And the warehouse was considered the first big piece of overall community redevelopment for the area. So the progress thus far would seem to justify the optimism, especially when you consider how the project has been able to plow through all of these obstacles in the last 18 months. But even so, I think Logan Herring would probably be the first to say that you really can't talk about success until you see the first Riverside residents moving into their new homes.
Thanks to contributor Larry Nightingale for his time this week. His Reach Riverside project update is available at DelawarePublic.org. And that's all we have time for on this week's edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, The Green can also be found via podcast at our website, on Apple Podcasts, and on the NPR One app. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, on Twitter at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Support for The Green comes in part from the Delaware Alliance for Nonprofit Advancement. Dana is an advocate for nonprofits, offering strategies to strengthen leadership skills, improve board effectiveness, and enhance nonprofit sustainability. Learn more at DelawareNonprofit.org. Thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible, contributor Larry Nightingale, Delaware Public Media's Roma Battalion, and our show producer, Rebecca Baer. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Burns saying thanks for joining us this week. And we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a first state of mind.